AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, this Sunday, April 27th, we're going to turn to what may well become in the future regarded as the dominant issue of our era, much like Vietnam was in the 1960s and 70s with repercussions we still feel today. We'll be talking about the war in Iraq, and to do that, we'll be talking about it with the person Seymour Hersh says is quite simply the best Western journalist at work in Iraq today. Patrick Coburn will be our guest today on Media Matters for what should be an extraordinary hour, so please join us. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The New York Times this week detailed a large, coordinated Pentagon scheme to sell the occupation of Iraq to the American public via a network of purportedly independent, retired military officers acting as paid analysts and experts for TV networks and cable channels. Not only did at least 75 of the military analysts meet regularly to receive talking points from the Pentagon, but many of them worked for defense contractors trying to profit from the war. Network officials and newspaper editors apparently failed to question or disclose these blatant conflicts of interest. Greg Mitchell is the editor of Editor and Publisher magazine and author of the book So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. He says that Times reporter David Barstow's article mostly focused on television, and it's important not to overlook the fact that all of the leading newspapers also frequently quoted the same members of the pro-war cabal.
You have to differentiate between the real punditry, the gas bag opinion shows on TV, which is most of them, and then real news stories. And I know readers have trouble sometimes differentiating, or sometimes they don't want to, but there's a big difference between a retired military guy going on Bill O'Reilly and spouting off, where people would expect that this is pure opinion and pure, you know, right-wing pro-war commentary, versus the same person being quoted in a news story as something of an expert, as someone who's going to balance someone else's view.
So why do so many reporters turn a blind eye to the true nature of these Pentagon shills? Mitchell says there are many reasons. One problem, he says, is that a lot of the editors and top reporters are inside the bubble of the Beltway.
You know, it's sort of going along to get along, and it's, you know, it's difficult work. There's fewer resources now, fewer people to do it, so I think they want to stick to something they know they can maybe accomplish rather than try to go back and turn over these stones.
Mitchell hopes that some of the more responsible news outlets will change their ways and ask more questions before presenting someone as an expert analyst. But he's not holding his breath.
You know, it wasn't very encouraging, if the reports I see were accurate, that they had the first press briefing at the White House yesterday, and the reporters did not ask any questions about this issue.
Free Press is calling for a congressional investigation into the Pentagon pundits scandal. For more information, go to freepress.net.
The issue of net neutrality has been front and center for Congress and the Federal Communications Commission in the past week. Last Thursday, all five members of the FCC were at Stanford University to hear testimony on the future of the Internet. Comcast, AT&T, and other Internet service providers want to eliminate long-standing net neutrality protections so they can block, slow down, or speed up Internet traffic whenever they like. Commissioners listened intently to more than 8 hours of testimony by academics, technology experts, economists, and representatives from public interest and political groups, as well as the public. More than 600 people turned out for the event. Stanford University law professor Lawrence Lessig cautioned against changing the open and transparent nature of the Internet.
We should be skeptical. We should have a kind of Missouri attitude here. Show me, right? Show me that innovation won't be harmed from this change. Show me investment won't be choked. Show me competition will continue. And until you show me that, don't allow this to change.
Michelle Combs of the Christian Coalition of America told the commissioners to make it clear that lawful speech rights of citizens will be upheld.
We believe that organizations such as the Christian Coalition should be able to continue to use the Internet to communicate with our members and with a worldwide audience without a phone or a cable company snooping in our communications and deciding whether to allow a particular communication to proceed, slow it down, block it, or offer to speed it up only if the author pays extra to be on the fast lane.
5 days later, the Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing on the future of the Internet. Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, who has co-sponsored bipartisan legislation, expressed dismay at those trying to put an end to the open Internet.
We're trying to determine how we might legislate here to restore that which always existed in the creation of the Internet, non-discrimination rules. I find it unbelievable that this is controversial. Who on earth is standing up for discrimination? I mean, it's just unbelievable to suggest that this is some sort of intensive regulation. It is not. It is a restoration of something that has great common sense.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest someone we tried to have on a year ago, direct from Iraq, but the telecommunications system in Iraq did not cooperate with us at that time, so we hope to have him with us live now from the United Kingdom. Our guest is Patrick Coburn, the Iraq correspondent for The Independent, based out of London, formerly worked with Financial Times. He has visited Iraq countless times since 1977 and has won numerous major awards for his reporting. He's the author of several books, including the brand new book, Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq, which has just been published by Scribner this month. Ann and I had the privilege of reading this book this weekend. Patrick Coburn, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you very much.
Where are you calling from, or where are we speaking to you from?
I'm in Canterbury, which is just outside London.
And when was the last time you were in Iraq?
About a month ago, a little under.
And if you to clear up exactly how much time you spent in Iraq, give some basis for the book you wrote. It says you've first visited there in 1977. How much time have you spent there in the past three decades?
I'm not really sure. I did once work out that I'd spent seven birthdays there. I don't know what that works out in terms of years. I was there during the first Gulf War and the uprising just afterwards, and during the second Gulf War. For part of the time under Saddam Hussein, I was banned, and I suppose I've been there about half the time since 2003.
When I was reading this book, and as I've been reading your dispatches in The Independent that are picked up in the United States, oftentimes on the Counterpunch website, I've been struck how the similarities between Iraq and Vietnam, in the sense that Vietnam was presented to the American people as a sort of a Cold War, a Manichaean situation of good versus evil and domino theories of world communist domination. And then once the United States got wrapped up in the war, people began to study the region and realize that had nothing to do, really, with what was going on in Southeast Asia. And to some extent, that when I read Muqtada, that came back to me, too, that I followed this issue, I thought, fairly closely, but I learned so much in this book that I didn't know, that I am well aware that I think few Americans are familiar with, and I think few American journalists probably are familiar with, really, covering Iraq today.
No, thank you. I'm glad you feel that. I feel that one mistake that is persistently made, both by proponents of the war and opponents as well, is to think that the United States always makes the political weather in Iraq, that they're the chief actors who really determine everything. While many things happen in Iraq which are to do with the U.S., but are also to do with other factors. So, Iraq is a very complicated country. It's a country with communities that people are unfamiliar with, that often have their own interests. And I think that a lot of the coverage is so orientated towards the doings of Americans in Iraq that the picture presented is very partial and very frequently also misleading.
You open the book, Muqtada, with the first section of the book is a really terrifying discussion of when you came near death and your effort first to make contact with Muqtada al-Sadr. Why did you decide to make that the way to enter a book that then turns to sort of a very rich history of the Shias in Iraq shortly thereafter?
Well, you know, first of all, it was a dramatic event. This is going down to Najaf and being picked up by the Mahdi army, who were very frightened at the time. And I was disguised because I thought, I was just wearing an Arab headdress because I was passing through, actually not through Shia areas, but through Sunni townships that were very dangerous on the road between Baghdad and Najaf. The Mahdi army thought I was a spy, kept on shouting, "American spy, American spy." And the two Iraqis who were with me thought that that's it, that they were going to shoot us there and then. And they were sort of almost but not quite decided to do so. Fortunately, I mean, obviously I did survive because one of them finally said, well, let's take it to our sheikh and let him decide finally. So obviously I survived. But I put it there partly because it's a dramatic story, but also it gives a sort of flavor of Iraq, because Iraqis go through this fear every day. I mean, Iraq, the characteristic of every part of Iraq, in the cities, out of the cities, is the checkpoint. You see checkpoints everywhere. There are 30 these days between Baghdad and Najaf. I went from Baghdad to Fallujah the other day, and I counted 27 on quite a short road. And many Iraqis just don't survive getting through a checkpoint, and they're always, their hearts are in their mouths when they do so, because they don't, you don't know who's there. You may be people in police uniforms, but who are they really working for? They may be soldiers, but are they Sunni or Shia? They might be anybody. And so I think it gives a sense of the sort of the stress, the fear that Iraqis go through every day of their lives.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Patrick Coburn, author of the new book Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq, just published by Scribner. Patrick Coburn is the independence correspondent covering Iraq and called by Seymour Hersh quite simply the best Western journalist at work in Iraq today. And for someone who's been a proponent of the war, issues high praise as well. Christopher Hitchens says no serious student of Iraq has failed to incur a debt to the intrepid and intelligent Patrick Coburn. One of the things that's striking about the book, you highlight this one particular individual, Muqtada, but as you point out, you don't really get to him till the second half of the book. I mean, the entire first half of the book is providing context.
Yeah, it's context and also history. I mean, why is Muqtada so important? You know, there are all these terrible journalistic cliches, the renegade cleric. You know, why is he cleric? Why is he renegade? I mean, he's always had the same opinions. He's not changed party. The firebrand, I mean, firebrand doesn't really mean much, just as a term of abuse. I mean, the reason he was important was he comes from an important clerical family, which opposed Saddam, that had many martyrs. His father created the Sadrist movement and was assassinated by Saddam's gunmen with two of his sons in 1999. The father-in-law of Muqtada was a famous Shia theologian who was executed by Saddam in 1980. So it's very important to give this this history. And then many things about Iraqi politics and why Muqtada is so important and become very clear. But if you just sort of start history in 2003, it'll all be inexplicable.
And if we could just go through a little bit of that history, I do want to get to the post-2003 situation, and I think many of our listeners are interested in that especially, but some of the points you raised and some of the discussion you made in the book that I wasn't especially familiar with, I found very enlightening and helpful. In particular, the relationship of the Shia with Saddam Hussein, historically, his regime from the very beginning, and during the war with Iran, which of course is a Shia country, and then leading up to the 1991 uprising of Shia, which I think might be one of the most under-recognized political events in Iraqi history in the United States.
Yes, I mean, I find it extraordinary. I mean, far more people were killed in the Shia uprising of 1991 than were killed in the first Gulf War, which has had endless books written about it, when the U.S. and its allies kicked Saddam out of Kuwait. But the uprising of the Shia, which followed, which was one of the sort of great rebellions anywhere in the world since World War II, is very little covered. but is actually a dramatic and traumatic event, which again shaped the political landscape of Iraq. There's one other point if I could make about this, that you know, there are many books about Iraq now, and some of them are good books, but they're mostly, again, about Americans in Iraq. They're about the Green Zone. Even when they're speaking of Iraqis, often the authority quoted is American. So I did go out of my way to make sure this book was all the quotes, I think almost without exception, are from Iraqis. If there's a description of a battle, there's Iraqis who are fighting in that battle are interviewed and quoted. And so I wanted it both in terms of topics like the Great Insurrection of 1991 and who is describing it. I wanted to make it a very Iraqi-centered book.
Now, the Shia are the majority of the Iraqi people, but Saddam Hussein was Sunni, and Iran is a Shiite country as well. In the 1980s, there was a war between Iraq and Iran, a very bloody war. How did the Shiite community relate to this war of Iraq against their Shiite brethren in Iran, and how did this affect Muqtada?
Well, the Shia were divided in their own minds about it. On the one hand, they were Iraqis. On the other hand, they were Shia. There were some who always supported the Iranians when to Iran, including, most of the part of the present government of Iraq. The Muqtada's family were nationalists. Often the Shia were nationalists and felt they were fighting Iran, but they had reservations about Saddam. But there was also, during the war, growing sort of, there was more Iraqi nationalism, but also there was growing antipathy to Saddam, who'd inflicted this terrible war on his own people.
Our guest, Patrick Coburn, author of the new book, Muqtada. We are taking calls. If people like to call into WILL AM 580, the telephone number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. This is a brand new book which presents an extraordinary account of the Sadrist movement in Iraq, and I think makes a compelling argument for it being at the center of any future for Iraq. We'll have to go through Muqtada and this movement, which I confess I knew far too little about until I read this book. One thing that you also talk about in the book that I thought was interesting, it's a subject of considerable debate in the United States, is the sanctions and the effect they had on Iraq following the crushing of the 1991 uprising of the Shia, following the First Gulf War. War critics in the United States, going back to the Clinton years, have been highly critical of the sanctions and have argued they levied an enormous toll on human life in Iraq. The Clinton administration and then later the Bush administration, and I think basically mainstream political opinion in the United States, has poo-pooed those charges and more or less ignored them and downplayed the effect of sanctions. You were there. Is there a right here, or is the truth in the middle?
No, there's a right and a wrong. I mean, sanctions did not, as we know, bring down Saddam. They did destroy the Iraqi economy, and they fractured Iraqi society. I mean, these people now refer to the great slums of Sadr City and of Basra. But why are these slums? It's basically because Iraqis were wholly impoverished by sanctions. I mean, I had friends who, worked at the university, had good jobs as professors, and then their salary was suddenly worth $3 a month. It was rather like, the Great Depression in the U.S., but if you can imagine the Great Depression even worse, and going on for 13 years. It hasn't really, up to 1990-2003. And, the tremendous psychological effect of the Great Depression in the U.S. was mirrored by what happened in Iraq.
And the human cost in terms of life, the numbers that we have heard in the United States, I've never seen anything authoritative, but have been put in the hundreds of thousands.
Oh, yes. I mean, and these are, organizations, UNICEF and so forth, produced these figures, which you can, there were lots of statistics on Iraq. One of the problems is about when people die like that, you know, they die not very dramatically. If you have a battle, you know, people die and it's you see the bodies lying there in a pool of blood. But often when people die because the economy is getting worse, it's because more babies die because they can't get clean water. They can't get clean water because the local water system isn't working and they're drinking dirty water from the local canal. It happens sort of silently, but it happens also massively. The very young die, the sick die, the very old die. So from having a health system, which was not bad and was about the standard of living was about that of Greece when I first went to Iraq in the 1970s, it slipped to about that of a Central African Republic.
Well, I'd say that's a fairly striking collapse.
It's an enormous collapse, and it sort of shaped what we have now. I mean, Muqtada's movement, which I describe, really comes from these great masses of unemployed, impoverished people from the Shia community of Iraq, the Shia, 60% of Iraq. And millions of these people were ruined by sanctions. The movement was built up by his father, who built up this sort of religious nationalist movement, which appealed to these people who'd seen their lives ruined. And that's why Muqtada is so strong today.
Now, we know that the movement that Muqtada heads, that burgeoned, blossomed in the 1990s under sanctions, was ferociously anti-Saddam. Why was it not pro-American since the United States came in and overthrew the Saddam government?
Well, it was against America. Why? Well, partly one of the reasons was sanctions. They saw the American hand behind sanctions. The Sadrists were not opposed to America overthrowing Saddam. They were opposed to America occupying Iraq. I think that, you know, it's a strange thing, but proponents of the war, people like President Bush, Tony Blair in Britain, always speak as though the occupation of Iraq automatically followed the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Now, most Iraqis were pleased to see the end of Saddam, and most Iraqis were opposed to the occupation. But there's no reason the U.S. should have occupied Iraq. There were alternatives. They could have handed over to the U.N. They could have just left. So I think, you know, that despite this cliche I mentioned earlier of Muqtada being a renegade. In fact, he's always been had exactly the same policy, which is to oppose the occupation.
And your book could not be more unsparing in its treatment of Paul Bremer and the occupation authorities. What did the United States do improperly? What has it done? And what is it doing to this day, in your view, that is not being especially successful?
Well, first of all, no country likes being occupied, and Iraqis don't like it. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of been speculation saying if there had been a better plan, if Donald Rumsfeld had planned better, had sent more troops in 2003, all would have been well. I think that this is a very spurious argument. I don't think if more troops would have made much difference. I mean, what Iraqis objected to was a foreign army running affairs in their own country, and there should be nothing particularly surprising about this.
But even in that context, it sounds like Paul Bremer did not do especially well.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it was appalling. I mean, I spent almost all his year there, and it was almost absurd if there was a mistake to be made. He was in there making it. There was an extraordinary mood of arrogance to begin with. You know, now people ask, you know, why was the Iraqi army destroyed, and say this is a terrible mistake, which is probably true. But I think that the mood was that the administration had been told, look, you know, that it was about the war was going to be difficult, and the war had been quite easy. American casualties have been low. The Iraqi army had broken up. Even the most elite divisions, which Saddam had lavished money and care on, didn't fight for him. And the basic fact was the Iraqis didn't fight. And so I think that there was a carelessness about what Iraqis thought. I mean, it's not that they had the wrong information. They just thought it didn't in the green zone. People around Bremer just thought it didn't much matter what Iraqis thought. Having said that, Bremer was extraordinarily insensitive, crass, knew nothing about Iraq, insofar as he took advice. He took advice from Iraqis who'd spent 30 years living in Detroit or Los Angeles or London. In 2004, he had this strange idea of saying Muqtada is, on the one hand, a great danger. He's the new Hitler, possibly the Hitler of Iraq. And at the same time was so negligible that he could, Bremer could send around a few Iraqi cops to arrest him. Now, one was might be true, or the other might be true, but not both. And, of course, it was a disastrous error, and there was a tremendous explosion. And most of southern Iraq fell under the sway of the Sadrists within a couple of days.
Our guest today, Patrick Coburn, author of Muqtada, the Iraq correspondent for The Independent, whose work can be seen easily on the Independent website here in the United States or on Counterpunch, which carries much of his material on its website. The phone number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. The phone lines are open. What is the political landscape overall? I think that was one of the things that I got from your book that I haven't really gotten from much of the U.S. news media coverage. How significant is Muqtada and the Sadrist movement, and who are the other main players contending for power in Iraq today?
Well, the government of Iraq is Shia, supported by the Kurds. This was always going to happen. I mean, as soon as the U.S. had decided to overthrow Saddam, two things were going to happen. One, that the Shia were going to take power because they're 60% of the population. And secondly, Iranian influence was going to increase because Saddam was their big enemy and because they're co-religionists of the Iraqi Shia. The big players now, the present government, which is actually supported by the Iranians as well as the U.S., the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki with a small party, Dawa, which doesn't have a militia. His big support is the Iraqi Supreme Council of Iraq, which is a strange organization because it was actually founded by the Iranians in 1982, although it has sought to be ally itself with the Americans since 2003 fairly successfully. These are the big rivals of within the Shia community. The rivals of Muqtada and his movement. Their support comes mainly from the established clergy, from the merchants, from the businessmen, from the better educated. Muqtada's movement is almost entirely the poor, the lower clergy, the small farmers. I mean, often there are divisions within the poor. In a place like Basra, for instance, the areas that give big support to Muqtada are called the marsh tribes. They used to live in the marshes until Saddam drained the marshes and they were forced to go and live in slums in terrible conditions in Basra. These people have had a very primitive lifestyle, but they're extremely tough, famously tough fighters in Iraq. Those are the sort of people who went and supported Muqtada.
Now, as we look at the situation, and as I read your book, in Iraq, one of the issues that comes up periodically is in the same, Muqtada gives his prayers, his speeches to his followers, involves always no to the United States, no to the occupation, no to Israel. And I was wondering how important is in the internal politics of Iraq or in the politics of the region, both the resolution of the Israel-Palestine issue to there being peace in these other nations, or does that really not have much to do with what's going on in Iraq?
It has a certain amount. It probably has less than before because Iraqis are so absorbed by the slaughter in their own country. But they probably exaggerate. At various points, they've exaggerated, I think, the influence of Israel on what's happening in Iraq. Just after the fall of Saddam, rumors spread in Iraq, and you'd see this painted up everywhere, that Israelis were buying up property in Baghdad. You hear other stories with slightly more substance that the Israelis play a big role in Kurdistan. I must say I've been there a lot, and I haven't seen them. I think Iraqis are basically absorbed by their own terrible difficulties.
Are the Shia, do they have a different attitude toward Israel than the Sunnis in general, or is that not a relevant
category? No, both are hostile. Both feel that Israel is a threat to the Muslim world. There isn't much division between the two. when Muqtada's father used to shout out, no, no to America, no to Israel, what Iraqis, I mean, this is an example of how Iraqis would look at things differently from others. What Iraqis noticed about these cries was that at no point did he say yes to Saddam. He would say yes to Islam, but he would not say yes to Saddam. And at that time, every newspaper in Iraq had to have a picture of Saddam. Television had nothing but Saddam. So what shouted out from the sermons of Muqtada's father was that he was not supporting Saddam.
In your work, you come across, I assume, a lot of American journalists while you're in Iraq and elsewhere, or some who are covering the war as well. One of the striking features that we've seen in the United States, and we had Greg Mitchell, the editor of Editor and Publisher, on, who has a new book on this, has been that the U.S. news media coverage has not especially been stellar at times of the war in Iraq, and has had to make apologies later for missteps, generally of a nature of just regurgitating government positions without enough factual basis to support them. And has there been a difference in your view from being there between the way the United States journalists are covering the story from journalists in other countries, or is this a, or is Greg Mitchell wrong, or is this a uniform problem?
No, for non-American journalists are more skeptical, but it's the U.S. that has kept the big bureaus there. I think there is a distinction between print journalism and television here that maybe not in the first couple of years of the war, when American print publications tended to be much less skeptical than they are now about military claims. They were slow on the uptake of that a really serious guerrilla war was taking place. I think they were also slow to say, which was perfectly obvious, that a civil war was taking place in Iraq in 2006-2007. But I think that if you go to the right places in the web, the right journalists, you could get a picture, a reasonable picture of what's really happening in Iraq. I think television, far worse, partly because it's a much cruder mechanism. Radio and print journalism, you can get more facts, they can be more nuanced. Television is much cruder. It was much more under the control, of pre-approval of scripts by New York, or and also, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, generals, American generals, retired generals who are supposedly objective commentators and analysts of what's going on, but all the networks had were wholly in the pocket of the Pentagon, were regurgitating what was told them, often had interests in companies that were connected to the commercial companies that were connected to the Pentagon. That the sort of analysis and reflection that was coming out of New York and Washington made, I think, anybody watching American television over that period just wouldn't have had a clue what was really happening in Iraq.
One gets the sense, watching American television and even reading some of our print journalists, although probably television plays a more striking role in American culture, is that our journalists, the American journalists at least, are largely holed up in protected areas, not really getting out and seeing much of the country. And, their flavor of the country, therefore, is really warped to what they can get from their hotel. Is this accurate, or is there a lot more going on?
I think it's exaggerated. It depends on who and when. I mean, there used to be more journalists who were like that. Now the number is down. There are specific people who go out and are very good, I think. For instance, McClatchy, used to be Knight's Ridder, has been particularly good at getting out. There have been other specific journalists who've got out and got the story. But often I've sat with them in Baghdad, and they sort of lament that somehow, although what they're writing is accurate, let's say about their skepticism about the surge, about what's really happening, but doesn't really set the agenda back home. Quite why that is, I'm not sure. I don't really see enough American television. Whenever I've seen sort of analysts or so-called experts from the think tanks in Washington commenting. This is almost invariably distorting what the reality is. Often they're contradicting what their own reporters are saying on the ground. The same thing is true of the op-ed pages in the major papers. I think that the Washington think tanks and the New York think tanks have generally played an extraordinarily negative role in coverage of elucidating what's happening in Iraq. I'd sometimes see these people. They'd come. They'd flit through the green zone. They'd go on sort of one embedded tour. You know, one guy had spent 1 hour in an American base on the outskirts of Mosul, the third biggest Iraqi city in northern Iraq, and went back and wrote a whole op-ed on this. You know, he really didn't know what was happening. He didn't even realize he hadn't actually been in the center of the city. So I think that the quality of the analysis and the commentary has generally been appalling. But I think that some of the reporting has been good. But somehow it hasn't been able to set the agenda. And I know the frustration of lots of American journalists, you know, really not just now, but over the last 5 years, that, you know, we've had these endless, spurious turning points of sovereignty returned to the Iraqi government in 2004, but everybody in Baghdad knew that the Iraqi army was completely under the thumb of the U.S. forces there. The capture of Saddam had made no impact. I mean, the surge had an impact, but it's been grossly exaggerated, and it's had a rather different effect than people imagine. But, you know, as we've seen the fighting over the last month, and with American and Iraqi casualties going right up again, that, you know, this is more of a lull than a real change in what's happening in Iraq.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Patrick Coburn, author of the brand-new book Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival, and The Struggle for Iraq, just published by Scribner's, an extraordinary book. Patrick Coburn has been described by Seymour Hersh as quite simply the best Western journalist at work in Iraq today. This book provides an understanding of the political forces within Iraq that I think is sadly absent from much of our media, and certainly was absent from my understanding of Iraq until I had the privilege of reading this book. My name is Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. In coming weeks, our guests will include Janine Jackson of FAIR, Jen Posner of Women in Media, Jim Hightower, Paul Waldman. We've got a lot of great shows for you, so please be sure to tune in every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. here at WILL. The phone number for anyone interested in calling in, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And Patrick Coburn, you know, as I listened to what you were saying just now, I think a question occurred to me, sort of probably the first question that most Americans have that still has never been answered. We see in the United States politicians and think tanks eager to pursue this war and defend it and push it, even when the factual basis of the arguments doesn't seem to hold together especially well. And we're left to wonder, why exactly is the United States in Iraq? What is the motivation? Because the stated explanations don't really hold up. And so you're left wondering, why does this war exist? And you've been there as much as anyone. I suspect you've thought about this. What is your sense for why this war took place and why what the U.S. is into it? Why we're there now?
I mean, a number of reasons I've always felt. One, they thought it was going to be a very easy war, and governments are always tempted by the thought that if they have a short, victorious war, that's going to secure their power at home. I think that the U.S. government thought that, after all, they'd had what appeared to them an easy war in Afghanistan. But again, they hadn't really won that war in the way they thought they'd had. Then they seemed to have then Iraq. They felt that this was going to secure their power at home. I think also, you know, it's fair to say that if Iraq had been, if the main product of Iraq was asparagus rather than crude oil, that enthusiasm in Washington to invade the place would be less. They felt there would be enormous opportunities there for U.S. oil companies. They also felt they would dominate the Gulf by installing a client regime in Baghdad. They lived very much in a sort of in a world of fantasy. Above all, I think of hubris and thinking that they were far stronger than they were. After all, this war was to prove that America was the sole great superpower of the world, to prove the enormity of its strength. And in fact, it's proved exactly the opposite.
One of the things that's striking from reading your book, and you refer to this on several occasions, is that Iraq is such a complicated country politically that, you know, the idea that even Saddam Hussein, who's, you know, fairly unsavory figure, he had difficulty running this country, running as a police state. So to think that the United States could come in as an outsider and govern it.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary country. I mean, that's the reason I kept going back there over the years under Saddam. I mean, it was, you had this very brutal dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, but at the same time, everybody in Iraq had a gun. You know, usually an assault rifle, not a shotgun. Saddam, yeah, I remember just after the fall of Baghdad, talking to an Iraqi doctor, a neurosurgeon, whose hospital had almost been looted. And I remember him saying to me, just when we'd finished speaking, he said, just remember that Saddam Hussein had real difficulty running this country. It's not going to be easy for the Americans or anybody else. And this, of course, turned out to be true. You have the different communities, Shia and Sunni Arab. You have the Kurds. You have smaller groups. You have different religious backgrounds, the Shia, the Sunni, and other. And you have each city with town with different loyalties and different parties. And you have tribes and you have clans. And Iraqi society isn't, you know, it's, there are a multitude of loyalties which appeal to people.
Let's go to the phone lines now. Our guest, of course, Patrick Coburn, author of Muqtada. The phone number here, 333-9455, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I read accounts that talk about Muqtada's movement not being funded directly by Iran, but special groups, as they call them, do receive funding. To what extent is there truth to that, or what is Muqtada's relationship with Iran? And the second question, what would an Iraq governed by Muqtada, if he was able to win elections and control parliament, what kind of movement would they make? Would it be a unified Iraq, or would there be a move towards partitioning? What can you say about that?
Yeah, the Sadrists, you know, do they get support from Iran? They certainly do. But traditionally, they've always been anti-Iranian. They've always been Iraqi nationalists. I mean, ironically, it's the people in the government who really were dependent on Iran before. So I think they went to the Iranians really on the principle, once the U.S. put pressure on them, on the principle of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But they remain very suspicious of the Iranians and vice versa. The second question was?
What sort of Iraq would there be if Muqtada was in power and could establish the politics of the country, the government?
I don't think he'd ever be in total power because he's a Shia, you know, and there are the Kurds and there are the Sunni. But I think it's very critical what the attitude he takes because of his massive popularity, at the end of the day, if there's going to be a deal with the other nationalities, he's about the only person who could really deliver it on the Shia side. I don't think the government in Baghdad pretends it can deliver a deal, but it can't really. You know, I keep on seeing and hearing when I'm in Baghdad these announcements from the government that sort of resonate abroad that they, you know, somebody new has joined their coalition. But if one's in Baghdad, one knows these guys can't leave the green zone or they'd be dead. But, you know, they can go abroad, they can go to London and Washington and waltz around just as if they were the leader of any unitary state. Now, I think Muqtada Assad's attitude is critical to the kind of government that Iraq gets in future, that if he wants a deal with the Sunni, he could deliver it. He also wants a unitary Iraqi state. But will that happen? I'm not sure. You know, I mean, the problem now is that Iraqis, Sunni and Shia, can hardly live in the same street. They're really frightened of each other. So many people have been killed. Remember, you know, a year ago, 3,000 people were being killed every month. There are a few mixed areas left in Baghdad. I mean, I have Sunni and Shia who work for me, and, you know, are very unsectarian, but they'll whisper to me, you know, if they're Sunni, don't let him or her know my home address. There's a real sense of fear and a real sense of difference at the moment.
Do you think that the situation has grown worse in the past 2 or 3 years?
Oh, yes, much. But, you know, we had this, you know, there was this absurd business of refusing to use the civil war word or phrase, but there was no doubt that there was a horrible civil war in 2006-2007, which between Sunni and Shia, and, you know, with bodies dumped everywhere. And it's, Baghdad's a little better now, but, or, you know, Shia don't walk in Sunni areas and vice versa. It's more of a lull than anything being ended. I mean, it reminds me of, I was in Beirut during the civil wars. It reminds me of Beirut at that time.
Are there any prospects?
When there would be less shooting, but everybody thought it could, the ceasefires could end at any moment.
Do you think there are any prospects for a viable united Iraq with a democratic form of government and civil society with reduced violence in the foreseeable future?
It is feasible, but it will be very difficult to do just because the bloodshed has been so extreme. I think it also means the U.S. leaving Iraq. I don't think people in the United States have really taken on board, one, the very simple fact, although it should be obvious, that everybody objects to an occupier. Secondly, the U.S. has been looking for a unitary government in Baghdad that unite your Iraqis. But that government is only really in business because it's supported by the U.S. Now, if we want a nationalist Iraqi government that's going to appeal to the national feelings of all Iraqis, you'll need one which isn't seen by so many Iraqis as a front for the United States. That tends to discredit its claim to be nationalist, to be representing the whole of Iraq.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We're talking with Patrick Coburn, author of the new book, Muqtada. Patrick Coburn speaking to us from Britain, but has spent much time in Iraq, as those listening to the show know already. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Patrick Coburn.
Hi. One thing that's bothered me for years is that I couldn't understand why Tony Blair supported the war for so long when, as I understand, the British people were not really behind them on that. Could you explain what was going on with Tony Blair?
I think Tony Blair, you know, his reputation in Britain was he always bet on winners, and he thought he was betting on a winner. He didn't know anything about Iraq. And there was a tradition of British policy of always supporting the U.S. But, I mean, Tony Blair carried this to an extreme. Then once they'd sent British troops there, they couldn't really think how to get them out. Currently, there are 4,000 British troops outside Basra. They don't do anything except being mortared and have rockets fired at them occasionally. But the government doesn't want to pull them out because of the offense it would cause to Washington. So I think that Tony Blair it simply miscalculated. He thought that, you know, this is an easy war. I'll go, you know, it doesn't have a downside for me. He just got it wrong.
One of the things in your book, Patrick Coburn, that struck me, and I went through the index to check it at the end, was there's only a handful of references to al-Qaeda in the book. Now, why this is interesting, especially in the United States, is that today in our political debates among presidential candidates in particular, It's difficult to have a discussion of the Iraq War and the U.S. role without a strong mentioning of the war on terror and mentioning of al-Qaeda and terrorism front and center, yet this barely really appears in your book. And you know, what is the stature of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and what is the relationship of Iraq to those forces in the world?
Well, of course, I mean, al-Qaeda in Iraq is somewhat different from the organization of Osama bin Laden. It's largely homegrown, although it obviously gets of supplies and a network to get suicide bombers from outside. Under Saddam, al-Qaeda had no strength in Iraq. Zarqawi, later its leader, now dead, was on the wanted list of the Iraqi security. They had a committee looking for him in Iraq. He was holed up in an area in Kurdistan that wasn't under the control of Baghdad. I don't refer to it very much, primarily because I'm writing about the Shia, and primarily I think also because its role is somewhat less. I mean, any time there's been talk of the insurgency of the last 5 years in the U.S., Al Qaeda is always mentioned, but this was only one group, and of course it did from the beginning because. And that this was a conscious policy of U.S. military spokesmen, as I think the U.S. press has shown, in Baghdad, was all that when the military or political spokesmen in Baghdad attributed any attack on U.S. forces to al-Qaeda, this led to more support for al-Qaeda within Iraq and led to more finance from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf and sympathetic Gulf countries.
Our guest, Patrick Coburn. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Patrick Coburn.
Yes, I have two quite unrelated questions. The first concerns, before Paul Bremer, there was another viceroy in Iraq who lasted, as I recall, only a month or so. And I've recalled reading a time or two that the problem with him was that he got in there and saw that with the system of food registration for distribution of food that they could set up and conduct an election right away, and he was preparing to do that, and that didn't suit the folks in the White House, and so that was why he was yanked. So my first question is, what is actually the case there? My second question has to do with the effect of the sanctions. And I think that I've read a couple of times that, for example, the part of Iraq that's controlled by the Kurds, they got along quite well under the sanctions regime. And that what was going on was that the rest of Iraq still had a reasonable income, but that Saddam chose to use it to equip his armed forces and build palaces and things. And it was the result of his decisions, mainly, that the effects were so bad on the population. And so I'm interested also in what you think about that.
Well, they're both good questions. Donna Bremer's predecessor, I'm not sure at that stage. I mean, at that stage, he thought the U.S. was going to be pulling out almost immediately. That was the big change when Bremer came in. The U.S. was going to stay and be the sort of occupying power. On the question of when elections should be held, during the first part of 2003 and the first part of 2004, the U.S. and the British and others said, no, we can't have elections because there's no way of doing it. We have to have a census and so forth. Basically, we're just trying to put off elections that they wanted to have their own government in. And actually, I remember seeing a General Petraeus, who was then commander of the 101st Division in Mosul at that time, and him saying to me, well, actually, we could have an election up here. In fact, his policy was to have as many elections as quickly as possible to give the local authorities that were running things post-Saddam some legitimacy. But there was this, I think, completely counter-effective policy of trying to delay elections and saying we should have governments and experts. It's just they had a pretty good idea who was going to win them, which was the Shia religious parties. They didn't want that to happen. The sanctions and the effect. I mean, this is a good question, and one I have strong feelings about. It was said that Saddam was sort of diverting all the money, but actually the way sanctions work, the aim of sanctions was to keep the money, all the oil revenue money, out of Saddam's hands. And so all this sort of bribery, deals with oil brokers was Saddam's attempts to get some of the revenue back into his hands, which he could do to some extent, but not a lot. The problem is, the reason sanctions destroyed the economy was that in Iraq, like all these oil states, most people work for the government. It's true today. I mean, there are 4 million jobs in Iraq with the government or people on pension who've just had jobs with the government. There isn't much of a private sector. Now, when sanctions were applied, the government didn't have any revenues. It couldn't really pay anybody. And that was a massive chunk of the Iraqi population. It was university professors, but it was pretty well everybody. The government couldn't really function, but just there was no money there. It was rather like, as if you all the money came from through committees in New York. It was rather like, as if Iraq had a Soviet-type economy applied to it, in the sense that all expenditure had to be okayed from the top. In this case, it had to be okayed not even in Iraq, but from another country. That why it had such a devastating effect. But was it true that Saddam was building palaces? Yes, it was, but, I mean, the palaces didn't actually, they weren't the reason that the economy was destroyed. I mean, Saddam in the 90s went through three phases. One was building these absurd palaces, which nobody ever lived in, all over the place. Actually cheap to build because nobody had a job, so labor was very cheap. Then he started building these gigantic mosques. He wanted to build the biggest mosques in the world. Couldn't be done because, the Iraq economy couldn't produce the sort of things you need to build them. Enormous domes, and finally ended up writing novels, which was a bit less damaging to his own people. But the basic point I want to make is that sanctions were cruel, and they destroyed the economy. They didn't destroy Saddam. They destroyed the Iraqi people.
Patrick Coburn, our guest today on Media Matters, we only have a little bit of time left, and there's one point I'd like you to talk about before we do have to sign off, which is there's been considerable debate in the United States about the actual death toll of the war since the U.S. invasion and occupation. And in the United States, the figures that are given by certain medical and international authorities, which have the death count as a result of the war being anywhere from 600,000 to perhaps as many as 1 million Iraqis, are immediately discounted and poo-pooed. President Bush himself has said those methodologies he found flawed. And the figure given, I believe, is in the range of 80,000 or 90,000 Iraqi civilians who have died as a result of the war and occupation. Any sense of where the truth lies on that one?
Well, I think it's, unfortunate it's the upper one. I mean, I don't know an Iraqi family that hasn't sort of lost people, I don't, when I stay in my hotel in Baghdad, I know the, just like the reception clerks, I know the son of one of them was kidnapped and then shot in the back when he was
Regrettably, Patrick Coburn, it's such an important issue, I have to cut you off because the band is tuning up in the background.
But I think it's very much at the higher end, unfortunately.
Our guest today on Media Matters has been Patrick Coburn, author of Muqtada. Thank you so much for joining us and taking time for your busy schedule to be with us today. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Matt Kessler, our technical director, and Andrew Boyle, our producer, for putting the show together. I'll be back in 167 hours. Thank you all very much.